This is Cosmic Perspective. I'm your host, Andy Panaros. Today on Cosmic Perspective, my guests are Dr. Carolyn Shoemaker and Dr. David Levy. On the 20th anniversary of their incredible discovery, they're here today to discuss Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. Dr. Shoemaker and Dr. Levy, welcome.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's wonderful. Great.
It's kind of hard to believe it's been 20 years since your discovery of this very special comet.
I'll say.
Yes.
Yeah.
Both of you had discovered comets previously, before Shoemaker-Levy 9. How did your passions for comet hunting bring you together to, I guess you can say, join comet hunting forces?
Carolyn, why don't you take off first on this?
We weren't actually brought together just by comets. We were brought together by the search for near-Earth asteroids, because Gene was trying to get a handle on the flux of near-Earth asteroids and comets and those that might actually hit the Earth. And so that was the focus of the program that Gene and I had. And we attended a meeting in Tucson one time. And at this meeting, we looked across the room, and there was David. And we'd never met David, but we had read his columns in Sky and Telescope and were really impressed with his background knowledge of things in the sky, and thought we would really like to know him. So Gene sort of pointed across the room, and David looked up, and he had heard Gene laugh. Gene had a laugh that you could hear for miles, practically. And so he knew Gene was there, and we saw David and got together, the three of us. David came over, and we started talking. We never quite stopped, did we, David?
No, we're still doing it.
David came up to Flagstaff a couple of weeks after that meeting, seems to me, and he wanted to see how we did things and how I looked for these objects on the films, and I always had a lot of films that I brought back from Palomar to search the skies with, and so I was able to show him, and we suggested that maybe he'd like to come to Palomar sometime with us, never dreaming that we would take off as a dynamic threesome, which we did. It wasn't right away, but it was several observing runs later, and Gene was gone, going to be gone, and I needed help to run the telescope and do the survey on those nights when Gene was gone, because we observed for 7 nights every month during the dark run. And so David came, and it was nothing short of a miracle. We had a lot of fun, and I would never have guessed that we could have gotten along so well, but we surely did.
It seems that it was a perfect fit for all of you. You got together.
And I think it was. I have my own little version of this. I've come to comets from a number of areas. The idea of comets as a science is something that came to me relatively late. But the idea of comets as part of human history, comets as part of human literature, especially with Shakespeare and other writers, and comets as just fun to observe is something that just really gave me the oomph to be interested in comets. I started searching my own program of searching for comets on December the 17th, 1965. And, trying to find there were two sources that really got me going, and none of them was a professional astronomer. In fact, just a few weeks ago, I was reading a professional paper that included two of the comets that I had discovered, and it literally, Andy, it put me to sleep. And the paper was so boring and so uninteresting to me that even though it was about comets that I had discovered, it put me to sleep. Maybe I need to read it again to get over some insomnia. But the things that really got me were the things said by some of the great writers in English literature. For example, someone that I think you and your listeners are familiar with, and that's William Shakespeare. And I think his most famous quote about comets goes like this: "Hung be the heavens with black, yield day to night. Comets, importing change of times and states, brandish your crystal tresses in the sky." 24 words. And the magic of comets is infecting the entire world. And the other person was someone who had just come out with an autobiography at the time that I had started my search for comets, and that was Leslie Peltier of Delphus, Ohio. And he had discovered 12 comets, but the way he described comets was also so poetic and so beautiful, I wanted to share it with you. He wrote, "I had watched a dozen comets, hitherto unknown, slowly creep across the sky as each one signed its sweeping flourish in the guest book of the sun." So with ammunition like that, it was hard not to get interested in comets. I started in 1965, found my first comet in 1984, and as Carolyn so efficiently explained, I bumped into Gene and Carolyn in 1988 at a conference. And my memory about my first observing session was that we were up on Mount Bigelow here in Tucson, and on the way down I thought, I'm going to ask them. I just am going to ask them, but they might say no. And Gene could tell I was a little uneasy about something. He said, "What's wrong?" I said, "I have something I want to ask you, but I don't know how to do it." And Gene said, "There's one way to do it, and that is just do it." And so I said, "Okay. I was wondering if you could use some assistance from me on some of your observing runs, because if you could, I would love the honor of observing with you." And Gene looked at Carolyn, and Gene said, "Oh, I think we might be able to arrange that." And so after that, it was just a matter of time before we got together. Our first session together was in 1989, and it was just a very pleasant observing session, something that I enjoyed immensely. And, you know, for the first few months, it was we were deciding each run. And then there was one observing run that I remember I wasn't with you. And then I remember the two of you called me, and I'm sitting at home, and Gene said, "David, I think we need you. We need you to give us some assistance and to be part of the team." And so I think I started going pretty regularly after that. And we found our first comet together in November of 1990. And then they just started coming in. And our total comet haul together was, I think, 13 comets that we found, 9 of which were periodic and given numbers from 1 to 9, and the others of which came once and then just never came back again. Mm-hmm. So that's the story in a nutshell, I think, from Carolyn and from me.
Well, actually, I kind of fell into comet hunting almost incidentally, because I really didn't think that I would ever be able to see a comet on our film. And then one time I was looking for a comet that had been discovered by Ted Bowl at Lowell Observatory. And when I looked at it on our films, on one film it was reasonably bright, and the other film it was very faint. And I thought, well, if that's what comets look like, I'll never find any myself. I'll never discover any. And his comet was on the way out after having passed the sun. And so I didn't really quite expect that I would be able to discover comets. But when I did and started actually seeing them, I discovered that comet hunting is addictive. It must be as addictive as anything I know, because once you actually discover a comet of your own, you just don't want to stop. You want to keep on. Don't you think so, David?
Yeah, that's for sure. And even though it's been years since I found one, and I probably will not find another one, I'm still doing it, and I still enjoy it. In fact, as we're doing this interview, I'm scanning last night's images that I took. I think I took about 500 or 600 pictures last night, and I'm kind of scanning them as we speak. But it is an addiction, but it is a passion with me, and it's something, mm-hmm. you know, I just call myself a night watchman. I just enjoy doing it. It's the search. If you don't enjoy the search, then you're not in it. You got to own it that way.
That's right. And it became a passion with me, too. I like discovering asteroids, and I like discovering near-Earth objects that are quite exciting, but there is nothing like a comet.
Yeah.
I can tell you just myself, being an amateur astronomer, seeing a comet naked eye and then through a telescope is, you know, quite an experience. And I hope that if our listeners here haven't seen a comet, they get a chance to see one.
It seems like there's something about a comet. It's almost alive, and I presume that's probably because it has a coma or a tail or both, and therefore really shows motion in a way that asteroids don't. And they just seem so exciting when you do discover them. There's no mistaking once you know.
And it's also their personalities. Every comet is different. Every comet is individual. And this morning, while looking at, there's a bright comet in the sky right now, Comet Pan-STARRS. And while looking at it this morning with my small telescope, it came into the field of view, and I said, "Oh, good morning, Comet Pan-STARRS. And how are you today?" And noticed that its tail was a little longer than it was last night, and it's just a wonderful thing to be able to look at it and just enjoy it.
What observatory and telescope did you use when performing your night sky surveys?
Well, Carolyn?
Well, we we did all of our observing together at Palomar Observatory in California, and we used the 18-inch Schmidt, which is really a very small telescope, especially in comparison with telescopes today. But it was the oldest telescope on Palomar Mountain. And because Gene was connected with Caltech, which owned the observatory, we were able to use it for free, which was important to our survey because we didn't have any grants or any money to fund the survey. It was really basically funded out of Gene's other project money. And that telescope was absolutely the ideal telescope at the time that we were using it for looking for asteroids and comets. It was ideal because it was a wide field. You could cover a lot of sky all at once, and you could do it quite quickly, and you could use film. And the film, even though it sounds like it was not expensive today, at $4 a crack, it seemed possible to us at that time. And so all of our survey was conducted on that telescope.
There was a friend of mine, Tom Glinos, who came up with his wife to visit one night after one of our observing runs ended, and he said, "I know you name all your telescopes, so what's the telescope what did you name this one?" And I had no idea because it wasn't my own telescope, and And so I thought I hadn't named it, but it's a very good question, and I really will give it a name right now. And I said, without really thinking, I said, the name is Mr. Banjo. And he said, oh, come on, give me a break. And I said, no, it isn't, because you remember the old 1950s song? Hey, Mr. Banjo, play a tune for me. And so it's kind of a nice little song, a nice little ditty. But there's one line in the song that kind of really got to me. The line that says, hurry, Mr. Banjo, the night ends all too soon. And that's the line that I told him, and I said to him. And I said, because the night, even though they're long, and sometimes over 12 hours long in the wintertime, they end all too early before you get a chance really to finish what it is that you wanted to do. And anyway, I named the telescope Mr. Banjo, and just 6 weeks after that night, we discovered Shoemaker-Levy 9. So maybe that was our Banjo comet.
And I understand that the night that you discovered the comet, you had a problem with the film, using the film that you used to survey the sky with.
Yeah, we sure did. Carolyn, why don't you tell that story?
Yes, in fact, we had had problems through that spring. In January and February, the weather was just terrible for observing. And it wasn't just for us. It seemed like it was not very good around the world. And so in March, when we went to observe, we took some film that we had prepared for the other observing runs. We prepared it by cutting it out or punching it out of 8x10 sheets. 8x10? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we started with.
And those round circles then were put in an ammo box and taken over to the 60-inch telescope where there was an oven. And we could hyper the film. That is, we could speed up the emulsion by running a combination of hydrogen, nitrogen gas through the oven and into the boxes. And that would speed up the film. And it meant that we could take 10-minute exposures instead of hour-long exposures. And we had saved film from January, and we saved the film from February. And when we went to observe in March, I had had that film in an old ammunition box, ammo box, which sat beside a little table where I worked at the Geological Survey in Flagstaff. And we just took that box back and put the film in the holder that first night and were ready to go. And Jane, as usual, after the first exposures were taken, rushed down to develop them and see how they looked. And they were totally black. And that was when we learned that someone had come along and opened that box of film in Flagstaff and said, oops, I guess I shouldn't, and casually closed it. And as a result, this whole stack of film was somewhat light-struck. The first films were totally black, and it occurred to Gene that maybe because they were nested, the film in the middle might be usable. So we tried that, and it was usable. The outside part of it was black, but the center part was still good. So we figured we could use that, and did on that first night. And then on the second night, we had prepared some fresh film, and we did have some clear periods and took a number of films. But by the third night, it was beginning to get cloudy. And we really wondered what we were going to be up against. We were eager to go and wanted to take some more films, and it didn't look like we were going to have much success. And we wanted to do some follow-ups. And the weather continued to move in. And after a few sets, we had to shut down. Now, generally the practice was that we would all go out and stand around and stare at the sky and stand on one foot and the other and say, you think it's going to be any better? And David was very optimistic, always very optimistic. And he said, well, I think maybe it's getting a little better. And Gene would say, no, David, those films cost us $4 a piece, and we can't afford to just waste them on nothing because the skies continued to be fairly cloudy. But as the evening wore on, things changed a bit. David, why don't you tell this part?
Well, in those days, you know, I really wanted to go after them, not like now, and like tonight is probably going to be a perfectly clear night, but the wind is too strong, and I never would have let that bother me in the past, but it would now. And so on this particular night, we were out there and looking at the sky, and I saw a couple little holes, and I said, look, there's a couple of holes there in the sky. Why don't we shoot through them? And Gene started laughing, and he said, you know, there's David, always the optimist. And he expressed it in economic terms. He said, it costs us $4 a film every time we slap a film into that telescope, and we simply cannot afford to be observing on a night like tonight. And I said, Gene, what about those bad films that were damaged? They're wasted anyway, aren't they? And he said, well, yeah, I might use them to do focus tests and things like that. And I said, well, why don't we use those and just see what we get? And Gene looked at Carolyn, and Carolyn looked at me, and I looked at Gene, and the two of them said as one, let's do it. And we went back in and set up the telescope, and the very next picture was the first of the two discovery films of Shoemaker-Levy 9.
And those were the kind of films that I hope no one else would ever see, because they were kind of embarrassing. Simply because they were so black around the outside. And the one with Shoemaker-Levy 9 in it had this very overblown image of Jupiter in it. Jupiter must have covered at least a quarter of the film. And it was so bright, and everything else looked reasonable until you got to the edges. But it was on films like that that we actually discovered SL9. And maybe that was all the more exciting because one wouldn't have expected it.
Sounds like a little bit of passion and destiny mixed together.
Yeah.
You didn't expect the comet to be exactly what you had seen when you looked at the film. Who was the first person to look at the film and observe what the comet looked like?
Oh, that was Carolyn.
I was. I was the person who generally checked the films for everything. And so that was happening on the next to the last night that we were there for our observing run. And by that time, not only had the clouds moved in, but rain and snow and sleet, and it was just absolutely miserable. David and Jean went over to the 60-inch with a box of new film to hyper it, and they came back, and nothing was happening. And by that time, I had just finished looking at the first night's films, and I hadn't discovered anything. And I was getting around to that, to the last set then, which included the SL9 that we didn't know about. And David was sitting over, I think you were working on a book.
Yeah.
Quest for Comets. And Gene was
You remember the name.
On, yeah. Gene was catching up on some reading, and a young Frenchman who was with us for that observing run had gone out to the car, and he was sleeping. So things were pretty quiet, and I put that first set pair of films on and looked at it, and I was just going along like usual, back and forth across the film so I wouldn't miss anything. And suddenly I backed that. I thought, there's something there. And it was fuzzy, and I thought, it must be a galaxy. But no, I looked harder, and it was floating. And the wonderful thing about the stereo microscope in discovering things is that if anything moves, it appears to float. And sure enough, this fuzzy thing was floating. And I thought, what on earth is that? And so I turned to the others and said, I don't know what I've got, but it looks like a squashed comet. It was like a bar on our films, a little short bar or hyphen. And Gene rushed over to look, and he was amazed. He just couldn't quite take it in. And David looked, and David was sure, though, that it must be a comet, that that fuzziness must be tail. And this was something that really puzzled us all. And Philippe came in from the car, Philippe Bendrea, and he took a look. And in France, he used to look for near-Earth objects and comets. And he took a look, and we were just all amazed. But sure enough, that was our introduction to SL9.
SL9 was the first comet discovered orbiting a planet. Is that correct?
I think it was. It was, although there were other comets that have briefly orbited Jupiter. But I believe this was the first comet discovered as it was orbiting Jupiter.
That's right. It was the first one that was seen while it was in orbit around Jupiter. And we thought that was pretty exciting, you know. That made it a different sort of comet. And the discoveries just kept coming one after another.
The comet itself, were you able to look at the film to see that it was fragmented? Could you tell first look?
Oh, yes.
You could tell, yeah.
There was no question about it that some catastrophic thing had happened to this guy. And, you know, that was obvious the minute, because when Carolyn said it's a squashed comet, that was because it had been catastrophically disrupted by Jupiter, and that's why it gave that appearance. But when Jim Scotti took the confirmation images that we asked him to take, I remember that he called me after he confirmed it, and his voice was almost unrecognizable. And I thanked him for taking these images for us. And he said, David, you don't understand. You don't understand the implication of this. I am going to spend the rest of the night on this comet and nothing else. I'm going to spend the rest of this observing period on this comet and nothing else. It is completely going to take over what I'm doing. And he actually knew it that night. And it turned out that he essentially did nothing else for the next 18 months except working on this wonderful little comet guy that we had found. It was really such an exciting, exciting thing 20 years ago. We'll never forget that.
And Scotty had this wonderful image that we really loved, because while we had the discovery image and we had this fuzzy little bar, he had something else, and that was a number of comets lined up with tails and then a wing extending on each end. And there was a lot of dust around, and it was an amazing image. And that's the image that I really carry in my mind for SL9.
Yeah, we were able to see those little dust streaks on either side of it on the discovery images. And the more I looked at it, the more I could just sense that we were really looking at a piece of history here, and something that clearly had not been seen before. It was exciting to beat all get out. I got to tell you, Andy.
I can imagine.
But at that time, Andy, we didn't know that it was going to come around in its orbit and impact Jupiter. That was yet to come, and we didn't know until May 22nd. The discovery was March 23rd, I think.
Yes.
And May 22nd, that's your birthday.
Yes, thank you.
And then we had word. David had gotten on his computer, and he had two circulars from the Minor Planet Center indicating that this comet was going to impact Jupiter. What a surprise.
That must have been quite an exciting time.
Yes, it was.
And two whole months after you discovered it, before you realized that it was going to impact Jupiter.
That's right. And part of it was just that because it was fragmented, each fragment had to be observed individually. Each fragment had its own orbit. And, amateurs looking at this comet didn't necessarily know because their telescopes were not as strong or no stronger than ours. They didn't necessarily know where the center of the comet was. When you measure a position for a comet, you try and hone in on the center of the nucleus, but you couldn't tell what the center of the nucleus was on this. Mm-hmm. So people were picking different spots. It was like in trying to figure out the position to report to Brian Marsden, I picked the brightest spot, and that happened to be fragment G. But it was not the center of the bar. It was not really necessarily the center of the comet. It was just the brightest spot.
It had an irregular shape with several fragments. That corrected. I believe
yes,
there were 20.
Did, but G was not in the center. Carolyn's absolutely right. One of the things that I remember now is that Brian, may he rest in peace, was so. He and I were actually we argued about everything, but we really were pretty good friends. And I had asked him one day if he were publishing an announcement that a comet or an asteroid were to impact the Earth or another planet, how would he do it? And he said, well, I would just put in the delta, which is the comet to planet distance, and then you'd see it get lower and lower and lower until the distance was less than the radius of the planet, and then you'd know there'd be an impact. And that's really exactly what he did. But he did something a little bit different, because in case someone missed it, he just said that it's clear that this delta J, which is the distance between the comet and Jupiter, is less than Jupiter's own radius, which means that there's going to be an impact. And that announcement came out on May 22nd, 1993, which is a day that we will never forget.
Quite a birthday present.
It certainly was.
It was pretty astonishing when David read these circulars and told me why. Then we started talking, and Gene was in the dark room at that point cutting film for a possible night's observing, and he could hear us and knew something was going on. And all of a sudden, slam bang, he shut the film up in the boxes and put everything away and rushed out so he could read the circulars. And he was so delighted because he had always hoped that sometime in his lifetime he would see an impact. And he kind of envisioned a possible impact in the wilds of Australia, where we used to go for the summer to study asteroid impact a long time ago. And he always envisioned that something small would come down and there would be a flash, and he would rush over and map a crater. And this, of course, was a little different, but he realized how different it was. It was much better than anything he could have wished for.
And it was just incredible. There was one night at the observatory that we were talking about our plans for Impact Week, and I kept on saying that I would be in California, where I knew the sky would be clear and I'd be able to observe it, and Gene kept on responding by asking me where I would be. And it was like he just wasn't hearing me, and I said, what's wrong? And he said, answer the question again, David. Where are you going to be for Impact Week, and I said, I think I'm going to be in Washington with you guys. And he said, that's the answer I wanted to hear. He said, that's going to be just about the most important week in our lives, and I think we need to spend it together. And we did, and it was so incredible, Andy, to be part of that history, and to be part of the in a way, in a very small way, an insignificant way almost, to be part of the evolution of our solar system. You know, actually, comets hitting planets, even the Earth, is a very common thing in the history of the solar system. However, in the story of civilization, it is not common. And the fact that we were privileged to be part of this event is, I think, something that none of us who were will ever forget.
You've discovered something that was never discovered before and has not been discovered since. I think that's a pretty special special comet.
Yeah, it is. I mean, people have found bright comets, like the Pan-STARRS people have just found a nice one. And I mean, that's something. But our comet was not famous for what it was. It was famous for what it did and its influence on Jupiter. In fact, there are still changes, chemical changes in the planet that have probably date from the impacts, and which haven't quite gone away yet. So that was an extraordinary thing, and something that we certainly won't forget.
And we were very fortunate in the timing of this, because the use of infrared telescopes had just begun to take place, and so some telescopes were using that technique. The use of the internet, that was just really beginning to come into its own. And believe you me, the use of the internet so that amateurs could take part in the event too was very important, because they made many important observations that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And you know, there were a lot of firsts on with regard to this comet. I don't think I've ever seen professional astronomers and amateur astronomers work so closely together. There was just a real cooperation. And so in the months after the discovery, actually about 16 months, everyone was deciding on what they were going to do at the time of the impact, and where they would be, and how they would observe, and what they would observe. And it was great, because there wasn't necessarily a lot of duplication, but there was a lot of variety in the observations. And all of it made the whole event so much better.
Shoemaker-Levy 9 became everyone's comet.
In a way, it was as if there's a football game, you know, the Super Bowl, and the people in the stands are watching the scientists and us on the playing field and shouting advice to us, and we're listening to it. It was like everybody was involved in this thing, and it's something that I don't believe has happened since then. It was a wonderful event to be a part of.
Do you remember how many days it was from the first impact to the last?
I think it was 6 days.
6 days. Mm-hmm. So it's over a period of time. And I don't recall the energy released. I'd forgotten the numbers, but I know that an incredible amount of energy was released on some of these, and all of them, of course, with larger, some pieces, some fragments were larger than others.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Some you could barely see, and then there were others like the G fragment and the K fragment, the W fragment, those were so bright and that you could get lots of observations of them, and it was important. You know you couldn't get all of them from one observatory. You weren't in the right spot, and we worried at the beginning because the impacts were going to occur on the back side of Jupiter. And gradually, as we knew more about where they were going to hit, that impact point moved over toward the morning sun. But it was a case of just really not knowing how much we could see, and so there were surprises that way. When we first saw the pictures, images that Hubble had taken, it was astonishing. You could see a plume rise, and it rose 3,000 feet above the sun.
Miles, I think.
Yeah.
Miles.
And then there was a bright flash, and that we learned that flash occurred when material that had risen above Jupiter fell back down and heated up as it fell, and you got this bright flash. There were all sorts of things happening that we didn't necessarily expect at all, and trying to figure out just what it was each time or was an exciting event.
I recall that the scientists expected the color to be different of the impacts when it impacted into the atmosphere of Jupiter. They thought they were going to be white, but they wound up being darker, like
That's
a blackish
right.
color.
We didn't expect the amount of carbon that was there. We probably should have, but it was not anticipated, and so you ended up getting these black spots on the face of Jupiter, and that was entirely unexpected. Yeah, a little white spot was what we had hoped for, not daring to dream any bigger.
Well, we know that the Earth has been impacted by comets and asteroids over the millennia. Most recently, the large meteor that exploded over Russia before it impacted. The shockwave caused buildings to be damaged and people to be injured. Do you think we have the technology to build something that we can send into space that would deter an asteroid or a comet from colliding with the Earth?
I think so. I think if we didn't have it, we would get it very quickly. But to be able to launch something into space and to send it a little bit like Deep Impact is something that we could think about doing. That of the movies that came out shortly after the impact that we were part of, a Deep Impact, I think, was the was a very good one that really told the story in a very accurate way. And I think that it could show that. Of course, we don't have a way to launch anybody into space right now. Attention, please, Mr. President. Let's get a space program going, because one of these days we're going to need it, and we really, you know, the Earth is definitely going to be hit again. The question is when, but it's going to happen, and let's be ready for it.
And there are a number of ways that have been suggested to prevent a large impact. They range from sending something up to an asteroid, for example, to throw off material, and in throwing it off, you get an impetus and you move the object. There's a solar sail that's been designed that you would attach to an asteroid, and the solar wind would help to carry the asteroid away. It would change its orbit. But something like we just saw over Russia was not necessarily a very preventable thing. It's been compared to the Tunguska impact in Siberia in, what, 1909 or something on that order. And it was an asteroid that broke up above the surface, and in so doing, gained a lot of energy, which was then responsible for breaking up the windows and causing damage to buildings. But that asteroid came in at such a low horizontal angle that we didn't see it coming. It was coming from the direction of the sun, and when objects come from that direction, you just simply don't see them. Your telescopes cannot look in that direction very easily. And so this was an example of a small asteroid. This one was smaller than Tunguska, and yet it caused a lot of damage, and we learned an enormous amount from it. People are going to be studying that for years, and it was a very, very exciting thing, because almost instantly, people around the world knew about it when it happened. When the flash occurred and when it broke up, people everywhere knew quickly. In Russia, in that city of 1 million people that it was close to, an enormous number of people have cameras on their cars, in part to avoid getting traffic tickets. And so they have cameras on and on their cars and record a lot of information. And we've gotten information and pictures that way. And there were meteorites that fell, and will provide a lot of information. All sorts of things that we can do today that we help us in learning that we haven't had before. And so we know these little tiny objects can be very dangerous, but they aren't easy to find. And one might say, well, should we worry about these little tiny objects to the extent that we don't pay attention to the big ones? No. The big ones are the ones that would really kill people and destroy cities and change the course of history. But the little ones tell us a lot, and there are a lot more of those.
Including one that I saw yesterday morning. It was part of the Lyrid meteor shower that comes every year. It's dust particles from Comet Thatcher that was actually here over a century ago. But this particular one was pretty large, and as it was coming into our atmosphere, I witnessed it. It was as bright as as a gibbous moon, and really very exciting to see. This has certainly been a fascinating conversation. Just wanted to mention the story about that, the fact that bright objects are hitting us all the time. You never know when something large or not so large is going to come into our sky. And that, to me, is the exciting thing about the night sky, is that you never know what's going to happen. It's always full of surprises.
Dr. Levy and Dr. Shoemaker, thank you so much for sharing the discovery of this very special comet with us today. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being on. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
And I really did enjoy it. Thank you for this honor today on our 20th anniversary.
Thank you very much. I feel very honored to have you both on. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.